This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Myth of the Nice Girl, Achieving a Career You Love Without Becoming a Person You Hate. Written by Fran Hauser with Jody Lipper. Performed by Fran Hauser.
Author's note. The one question I've been asked the most over the course of my career is, how can you be so nice and still be successful? It first struck me that this is a real issue that women struggle with when I was president of digital for People magazine back in 2009. So many of the women I worked with and mentored wanted to better understand how I had risen to that leadership position while having a reputation for being so nice. I came to realize that many of these young women were convinced that they had to somehow suppress their niceness to get ahead. They were worried, and sometimes rightly so, that if they acted kindly and collaboratively at work, they'd be labeled as too nice. The ongoing myth of the nice girl is that she's weak, a pushover, a people pleaser, and clearly not someone who is a natural leader or super effective at her job. At the same time, these women were concerned that if they voiced their opinions, stood up for themselves, and put their own ambition first, they'd end up in another box, this one labeled bitch. One after another, women asked me how they could find the perfect balance between being nice and being strong at work. The truth is that it's taken me years to find my own balance, and it's something I still struggle with from time to time. When I was in my 20s, I received advice from bosses and mentors to act tougher and to develop a harder edge. "Fran, you're too nice," they told me. "You need to toughen up or people will walk all over you." I bought into this myth and tried stifling my empathy and kindness, but the truth was behaving that way just wasn't me. It felt fake and inauthentic. Plus, I saw that it wasn't as effective for my career as using kindness had been. After years of self-discovery, building a successful career, and paying close attention to what worked, and most importantly, what felt right for me, I ultimately came to see that I didn't have to sacrifice my values or hide my authentic personality in the name of achieving success. In fact, as I learned to own my natural kindness, it has become my professional superpower. It has helped me build my personal confidence, the loyalty of those who've worked with me, and a strong, trusting, faithful network of colleagues, mentors, and mentees. I fully believe it can do the same things for you. Over the past 8 years, I've had thousands of conversations about this topic with women. One-on-one, via social media and digital mentoring platforms, and through speaking engagements. I've shared my own experiences, as well as the insights from my various mentors and colleagues. Back in 2009, I also did some research to see what resources were available for all the women who were facing the same issue. But what I found was disappointing. No business guide seemed to regard being nice as powerful at all. In fact, too many books still put forward the myth that nice girls can't get the corner office or become respected leaders. That was when I realized that there was a need for this book. Then my life took a turn. Our first son, Anthony, came into our lives in 2010, and our second son, Will, followed in 2011. Between being a mom and having a demanding career, my life was overflowing, so I pressed pause on writing the book. Then in 2014, I took the scary and thrilling step of creating a new career for myself. I left media and moved into startup investing. When I saw just how much my network helped support me in that career transition, I started thinking seriously about the book again. The breakthrough moment for me was a blog post I wrote for Forbes.com in January 2016, entitled, "How Nice Women Can Finish First When They Ask the Right Questions." It really struck a chord with readers and became one of the most popular posts in Denise Ristori's Mentoring Moments series. I was suddenly overwhelmed with women reaching out to me through Facebook, Twitter, and email. That was when I knew that not only was there still a need for this book, but that I had to write it. While I've received very strong support for the book in many circles, I've also received pushback from others. The word nice is emotionally loaded for many women. Some have an immediate adverse reaction to it. I fully understand that, and it's precisely why I want to rebrand the idea of a nice girl as someone who is not meek or a people pleaser, but who uses her authentic kindness to sidestep regressive stereotypes about what a strong leader looks like. There is real power hidden in traits like empathy, kindness, and compassion that are undervalued in the business world. When coupled with an appropriate dose of savvy and ambition, these overlooked superpowers can help launch your career to the top. In these pages, you will discover the principles that have allowed me and hundreds of other strong, kind women to rise above double standards and thrive in the workforce. The Myth of the Nice Girl will show you how to negotiate powerfully, to speak up so people listen, to project confidence, to own your decisions, and to deal with conflict, all while never hiding the nice woman you know yourself to be. When you reject the outdated playbook that says you must be ruthless in order to succeed in business, and instead learn how to harness the untapped strength of kindness, your power to achieve your dreams and goals will be unstoppable. Chapter 1. Nice is your superpower. When I was in my early 20s, I was working at Ernst & Young, one of the biggest professional services firms in the world. I was young, ambitious, and extremely hardworking, and I was doing well in my role there, but I was also getting a lot of feedback from my boss about specific things I needed to work on. For example, one of the companies my team was assigned to service was Coca-Cola Bottling Company of New York. I was the youngest person on the team and felt incredibly intimidated by one of the vice presidents at Coke, who was an imposing older man. In our meetings, I found myself constantly nodding and agreeing to pretty much everything he and the other people in the room said. I was just too nervous to speak up and voice my own opinions. Either that, or I uttered a noncommittal, "That's interesting." No matter what subject was being discussed, we could have been talking about what to get for lunch, and if someone had suggested sushi, my response would have been, "That's interesting." I just didn't want to make waves or create any conflict by voicing a strong opinion one way or the other. It was my way of showing interest and being a part of the conversation while always trying to remain agreeable. But looking back on this, I can't help but laugh at myself. Who knew that sushi could be so interesting? One day, after one of these meetings, my boss pulled me aside. "Fran, you're yesing the client to death," he told me. "It's okay to push back sometimes if you do it respectfully. It actually makes you less interesting to just say yes or that's interesting all the time. You need to start saying something more significant and sharing your opinions." This was the first time I realized that I was trying to be too much of a people pleaser at work. By hiding behind a facade of agreeableness, I was hijacking my own effectiveness. Of course I had my own opinions and ideas, but I had been waiting for permission to share them, and now I had it. In the next meeting, the client made a suggestion about changing how we disclose certain information on the quarterly financial statements. I thought it was a great idea, but I wasn't sure that we could make the change and still meet our deadline for that quarter. Feeling nervous and with my voice probably quieter than it should have been, I said, "Why don't we implement that change in the next quarter so we can make sure to meet this quarter's deadline?" After I spoke, I looked up at the client nervously, afraid that he would think my comment was stupid or off-putting. "That's a good point," he said simply, and I breathed a huge sigh of relief. Over the coming weeks, I started speaking up more and more, and I grew increasingly comfortable with voicing my thoughts. I knew it was working a few weeks later when the client stopped at my cube after a meeting and actually asked for my opinion about something. He had never done this before. I realized that by sharing my opinions on a more regular basis in our meetings, I'd proven to him that my thoughts had value. This was a big step in the right direction, but I was still getting some negative pushback about my relationships with people in-house. I was spending a lot of time trying to get my colleagues' buy-in before making a decision, and I had a mentor who kept encouraging me to toughen up and stop worrying so much about what other people thought. I had a colleague named Jane who was responsible for giving approval for the proposals we sent out to clients. Jane was notorious for taking her time with her approvals, and she always gave me a hard time, especially when I approached her with a tight deadline. Normally, I did my best to accommodate her. When my boss came to me with a new proposal that he needed to send right away, I was torn. My gut told me to go to Jane and just honestly explain the situation, but I kept hearing my mentor's voice in my ear, telling me to be tougher and to stop worrying about getting other people's buy-in. Finally, I decided to go above Jane's head to her boss, Eric. I knew he would understand the urgency and give me the approval I needed without asking too many questions. And he did. My boss was pleased, my mentor approved, and the proposal was a win. But knowing how I had bypassed Jane, I didn't feel right about the way I'd gotten that win. I asked myself how I would have felt if someone treated me in the same way I treated Jane, and the answer was not good. I had disenfranchised her by going above her head. And sure enough, that ill-gotten win came back to haunt me the very next time I needed approval from Jane. She said no. I went back to Eric, but he told me, "I'm sorry, Fran, but you need to work with Jane on this one." Deep down, I knew he was right. I couldn't keep going above Jane's head. I needed to find a way to work with her. But at this point, I was so confused about how to go about it. Should I go with my instincts to be nice and accommodating, or double down on my new tough approach that had gotten me the results I wanted last time? Feeling torn, I thought back to my original role model and source of inspiration, my mother. She was an Italian immigrant. My family moved to the United States when I was 2 years old. With four children when she opened a tailoring shop in Mount Kisco, New York in the 1970s. Her English was broken and she didn't have any professional training, but she managed to become a successful small businesswoman. This was thanks in part to her skills, but mostly due to her personality. She was always incredibly kind and loving to her clients, and they absolutely adored her for it. My father was the same way, a stonemason who served mostly wealthy local clients. He was, and still is, one of the most beloved members of our community. My parents' clients were always loyal and incredibly giving to my family. They gave us bags of hand-me-down designer clothing, let us use their swimming pools in the summer, and one of them even sold me my first car, a 1970s baby blue Fiat with no power steering, for just a few $100s. But it wasn't just about generously sharing their wealth with us. These people genuinely liked and respected my parents because they were so nice. I thought about my situation with Jane and asked myself what my parents would have done in a similar situation. While I was trying to succeed in the corporate world rather than in a tailoring or stonemasonry business, it was important to me to develop the same types of relationships with colleagues and clients that my parents had with theirs, and to do it in a way that I felt good about. I went to Jane the next day and asked her out to lunch. She hesitantly agreed, and as soon as we sat down, I apologized straight from the heart. "Jane," I told her, "I really messed up." I explained the pressure I was feeling to deliver a fast yes to my boss. Knowing how quickly we needed the proposal turned around, I felt in the moment that it would be best to go to Eric right away, I said. "But I realized after the fact that I disrespected you and didn't give you a chance. I'm so sorry, and I promise that going forward, this will never happen again." I could see a wave of relief come over Jane, and she graciously accepted my apology. For the rest of our time at lunch, I took advantage of the opportunity to get to know her a little better. I learned that she had two young girls, and when I asked to see pictures of them, Jane's face completely lit up. This was a lovely side of her that I'd never seen before, a side of her that I'd never given myself an opportunity to see. I stayed true to my promise to never again go above Jane's head. But more important, I was never even tempted to. Jane and I developed a great working relationship. Whenever I needed something from her, I made sure to go to her first. I also frequently went out of my way to touch base with her and ask about her daughters. I found that she was so much more receptive to my requests, even under tight deadlines, when I made a personal connection and she saw that I truly cared about her life outside of work. Nice is your capital. This was a huge turning point for me. Seeing how well my instincts to be nice served me with Jane inspired me to embrace this intrinsic part of my personality at work. But I also didn't ignore my mentor's feedback to toughen up. I definitely needed to balance my natural niceness with a good dose of strength. Over time, I was surprised to find that owning my niceness actually made it easier for me to speak up, push back, and voice my opinions at work, because I wasn't so consumed by trying to be something I was not. Instead, my confidence soared, along with my effectiveness, because I was finally free to be my authentically nice and caring self. This doesn't mean it was an overnight fix. Quite the opposite, actually. It's been a lifelong struggle for me to find that perfect balance between being nice and being strong at work. But what I learned from my experience with Jane was that I didn't have to hide that part of me any longer. I'm so grateful that I learned that lesson when I did. Once I truly started to own my niceness, it became a huge asset throughout my career. Of course, Jane wasn't the only person who responded more positively to me when I treated her with genuine kindness and compassion. Most of the people I encountered at Ernst & Young, and later at Coke, Moviephone, AOL, Time Inc., and then as an early-stage investor and advisor, were more likely to remain loyal, stick with me in a negotiation, pick up the phone, return an email, do me a simple favor, and even bend over backwards when I needed them to, all because I'd previously treated them kindly. Yet, despite all of these experiences, I still found myself at times struggling to accept the fact that being nice was such a big part of my identity. In fact, when I was first thinking about writing this book, I had mixed feelings about it. On the one hand, I was excited about the possibility of helping other women balance kindness and strength at work. But on the other hand, I wasn't sure that being nice was what I wanted to be known for. Did it mean that people saw me as weak or ineffectual? When I voiced these concerns to my friend and author, Tiffany Dufu, she looked at me with a big, wide smile and said, "Fran, you are already known as the nice person. It's why people always call you back. It's why people will drop whatever they are doing to be helpful to you. Nice is your capital." In that moment, I knew in my heart that she was right. Being nice was a big part of my brand. But then I started wondering, if someone like me, who generally took pride in being nice, had mixed feelings about this, how many other women were repressing their authentically kind selves at work because of anxiety about being perceived as a pushover? My own reaction told me that this was indeed an important subject for me to explore further. Of course, I'm not the only woman whose niceness is her capital at work. When I asked more than 1,500 working women whether or not being nice has been helpful to them at work, 95% of them said yes. Here are some of the wonderful things these women had to say about how being nice has helped them succeed. Being nice has actually been an incredible asset when I needed to pull in favors. In my past life, I was commonly called the Velvet Hammer because I was nice and could quickly deal with tough situations head on. Being nice has helped me turn large teams around that were underproductive as well. Because I'm nice, I'm able to ask special favors of partners' clients when I need it. I've even stayed on good terms with nearly everyone I've laid off. My team is unbelievably loyal. I feel that killing someone with kindness will get you further in life than coming across as angry or mean. I'm constantly told that my choice to use empathy is what makes me both a strong and approachable leader. The double bind between nice and strong. And yet, despite their clear understanding of how being nice has helped them succeed, these same women, 76% of that 1,500 to be exact, said that they felt caught in a double bind at work between the need to be nice and the need to be tough. They reported things like, "I really don't like feeling that I can't be nice and assertive at the same time. It's as if I'm trying to mix oil and water, even though I know it shouldn't be this hard. I'm a petite woman who looks younger than I am, so I tend to overcompensate by trying to assert my competence or stature, and I worry that it comes off wrong." Women are expected to be nice, and leaders are expected to be tough. What's an ambitious young professional woman to do? Reading these comments, it struck me how loaded the word nice was for so many of these women. The majority of them believed that it was code for being weak, ineffective, a people pleaser, or a pushover. Others thought it meant someone who was pleasant to be around. A good team player, sure, but not someone who could ever stand out or be a strong leader. But I've come to learn that the strongest, most effective leaders are often also the nicest. They use their kindness to inspire their teams, encourage others, and create powerfully positive workplace environments in which their employees thrive because they're happy, engaged, and motivated. These aren't just my observations. Research shows that a positive work environment leads to greater productivity, lower turnover, and even better health outcomes for employees. While working in an environment that is hostile, anxiety-provoking, and negative leads to lower productivity and performance, not to mention a lack of fulfillment. Specifically, happy workers were found to be 12% more productive than their unhappy peers. This attention to environment is more important than ever in contemporary workplaces, because so much of what we do every day requires collaboration rather than solo performance. A recent study from the Harvard Business Review found that over the past two decades, the amount of time the average employee spends working with colleagues has gone up by over 50%. Today, we spend more than three quarters of our workdays communicating with coworkers. This clearly tells us that there's never been a better time for all women to reclaim our niceness and start using it to win and to help each other win in the workplace. The truth is that we do not have to choose between strength and kindness or confidence and likability. We can be considerate of others and ourselves, accommodating and assertive, someone who speaks up and is humble, a team player who still always looks out for number one, you. And we can do that by embracing the traits of kindness and compassion that feel authentic to our personalities. My friend Emily Dalton, the co-founder of the men's grooming line Jack Black, is a great example of this. But it took a personal tragedy for her to start owning her niceness. Emily admits that when she was younger, she was a goody-two-shoes, always seeking approval and wanting to be liked. But growing up, her professional role model was her dad, whom she describes as a grizzly bear. He was demanding, gruff, and went into battle over anything and everything. At the beginning of her career, Emily felt insecure about being her nice self at work, given that she had a strong role model in her rough and tough father, who was admittedly harsh but almost always got results. She played along with this modeling, and in difficult situations, she often found herself compelled to be confrontational. This approach did get results in the short term, but it was destructive in the long term, because it kept her from building stronger, more lasting relationships. Several years into her career, Emily's father grew ill and shared very honestly with her that he regretted the way he'd often acted in difficult work situations, and that he in fact saw this as one of his personal weaknesses. Facing death, he shared the powerful insight that relationships were the only thing that really mattered. This was a huge wake-up call for Emily. She started to transform her behavior in difficult situations, letting her natural kindness shine through. She quickly found that being nice helped inspire her team to relax, be more creative, and become less afraid to take risks. Emily saw how beneficial being nice was for her professional relationships in the long term, and how often people were willing to go the extra mile for her, simply because they felt they'd been treated fairly and with respect. Emily admits she's still trying to find the perfect balance between being fair and firm, empathetic and challenging, but she's making good progress. And now Jack Black is the number one selling prestige men's skincare brand in the United States. Emily, along with the many successful women I'm lucky enough to call my friends, several more of whom you'll read about throughout this book, and I are proof that nice doesn't just help you make friends and be well-liked. It can vault you to the top. What does it mean to be nice? First, I want you to have a clear understanding of what I'm talking about when I use the word nice. I'm not talking about someone who is merely pleasant to be around, but perhaps is boring, unintelligent, or incapable of holding her own. And I'm certainly not telling you to play to the regressive stereotypes that demand constant sweetness and compliance from women. Instead, I'm describing a woman who cares deeply about other people and who wants to connect with them, who's guided by a strong sense of values to do the right thing. She is considerate, respectful, and kind. There's a warmth and magnetism about her that draws people to her side and makes them feel good in her presence. At work, she's fair, collaborative, and generous. Instead of competing against other women, she elevates them by sharing the credit for a job well done. She has a deep, unshakable confidence that there are plenty of opportunities to go around. My friend Patricia Karpis is the epitome of this type of women. I met Patricia when I was working at AOL. She has held executive roles at CNBC, NBC, AOL, and Time Warner, and is now a successful entrepreneur, having co-founded the award-winning meditation studio app. Yes, she is a total badass, and she's also one of the kindest and most grounded people I know. When I got home from the hospital after adopting my first son, Anthony, in 2010, The first thing I saw on my kitchen table was a bag of my absolute favorite cookies, the huge chocolate chip walnut ones from Levan Bakery in New York City that she had shipped to me. I was so touched by the sweet and thoughtful gesture, and it made me think about how I've also seen Patricia use her genuine kindness to win at work. When she was at NBC during the early days of branded television content, Patricia was tasked with working with IBM on a show they wanted to create and sponsor called Scan, about cutting-edge technologies around the world. The problem was the CNBC editorial team she was collaborating with didn't want an advertiser like IBM to have influence over a show's content, and IBM wanted some editorial control of the show. Because Patricia had earned the trust of both teams, she was able to make each feel comfortable enough to work together on a show that everyone was happy with. They trusted Patricia because she had taken the time to build up strong, authentic relationships with the people on both teams. This ended up being a win for Patricia, for NBC, and for IBM. And it's a great example of how Patricia intentionally used her authentic niceness to find success at work. Another woman who I think embodies this definition of nice is Anne Moore, the first female CEO of Time Inc. When I was working at Time, Anne was one of the most powerful women in the corporate world. She was a very strong leader, but what I really loved about Anne was that she had a very human, relational, and relatable side to her. Every month, Anne invited people from all different departments of the company to a breakfast meeting. She started each of those meetings by going around the room and asking each of us to share something we were grateful for. It was such a beautiful way to open those meetings because it created a positive mood and helped us all see each other as three-dimensional human beings, not just someone who filled a certain role at work. Anne was always very rigorous when it came to the financial side of the business, but taking the time for things like this made working at Time Inc. enjoyable and rewarding. Her employees tended to be loyal, which meant that her kindness was actually very good for the company's bottom line, too. You see, it's not enough to just be nice in a general way, though that's certainly a good start. The key to making nice your superpower is to own your niceness and use it intentionally by connecting it to the things you care about. That's what Patricia and Anne have done successfully, and that's exactly what I want to help you achieve. Don't fake it till you make it. All of this is not to say that you should start putting on a phony nice facade in order to get what you want. Quite the contrary. Just like my attempts to ignore my innate niceness and act tough early in my career didn't work, faking nice will never work either. My definition of nice is all about doing the right thing because it feels natural to you, not because of what's in it for you. It's relational rather than transactional. Yes, being nice will help you get ahead, but not if you're being nice just to get ahead. When you aren't being true to yourself, it's impossible to feel confident in your own skin. It's very uncomfortable to pretend to be something you're not. And it becomes nearly impossible to live up to your potential because you're so focused on keeping up the facade. True success comes when you use your talents and your genuine kindness to do work that is aligned with your values and passions. This is how you can leverage all of the best parts of you. Without this type of genuine kindness, it's impossible to form sustainable relationships. Think of it this way. If your kindness is the foundation for your friendship and it's authentic, that relationship can stand strong. But if that kindness is fake, your relationship will inevitably topple. It all goes back to trust. If you're inauthentic, people won't trust you. And without trust, there is no relationship. Research shows that our instincts tell us to ask ourselves two questions when we first meet someone. Can I trust this person? And can I respect this person? We look to a person's genuine warmth and competence to answer these two questions. Interestingly, the first question, can I trust this person, is the more important one when it comes to how we evaluate others. In fact, we only evaluate someone's competence after a sense of trust has already been established. This means that if someone decides they can't trust you, either because you lack warmth or display inauthentic warmth, you won't be able to get very far with them. Even worse, they'll view your attempts to come across as smart or competent as manipulative. They will resent your strength instead of respecting it. On the other hand, according to the same study, if you come across as warm and trustworthy first and prove your competence later, people will admire your strength and evaluate you far more positively. This is a powerful argument for always leading with kindness in the workplace. How nice is too nice? Of course, like any other characteristic, even positive ones, it's possible to take niceness too far, both at work and beyond. If we allow ourselves to become pushovers, then our kindness stops being an asset and becomes a liability. In fact, most of us have certain areas where we're more likely to overdo it when it comes to being nice. For example, empathy is my Achilles heel. I have a natural tendency to worry so much about how I'm affecting others that I sometimes let that impulse get in my way. It's something I have to actively work against so that I can find balance. I share my techniques for addressing this issue throughout the book. Maybe your Achilles heel is seeking too many outside opinions before making a decision, or failing to voice your opinion on a sticky subject. Throughout the book, you'll likely become aware of certain areas where you need to embrace more kindness, and other areas where you need to tone it down and start putting yourself first. Maybe a boss or colleague has already told you that you're too nice. A full 50% of the women I surveyed had heard this before, from bosses, colleagues, clients, and everyone in between. No wonder so many women feel caught in that double bind between being nice and being strong at work. To me, this finding simply illustrates how important it is to reclaim nice and redefine it. Through your success, confidence, and all-around sense of authenticity, you can prove to those around you that being nice and effective are not mutually exclusive. My friend Kat Cole has struggled with this misconception about niceness throughout her impressive career. Kat started out working at a Hooters restaurant while she was in college. By the time she was 19, she'd already been a waitress, bartender, and manager when the Hooters corporate office asked her to help launch the first Hooters in Australia. Kat had never even been on a plane before and was excited about the opportunity. The corporate team told Kat that one of the reasons they had chosen her for this role was that she got along so well with her peers and had been helpful to others in many different situations. Kat was in Australia for a little over a month, and then Hooters asked her to take a leadership role in opening their first restaurant in Central America. For the next several years, Kat was promoted every 18 to 24 months, in part because of her genuine kindness and generosity. She also volunteered a lot in the restaurant industry, which helped her meet mentors and build valuable relationships. By the time Kat was 26, she was one of the vice presidents of Hooters. She led all of the company's training and operational franchising, and was almost always the youngest person in the room and or the only female. Yet amazingly, despite her extraordinary success, people constantly told Kat that she was too nice. They seemed to think that just because Kat was young and female, she needed to put on a tough girl facade in order to get ahead. This clearly couldn't have been further from the truth. If anything, Kat knew that she wouldn't have become so successful if it wasn't for her kindness. So when people told her that she was too nice, Kat started telling them, "Just so we are clear, don't mistake my kindness for stupidity." I love this approach, because it shows that Kat is not afraid to step up and own her niceness instead of apologizing for it. With that one statement, she's able to prove that her kindness does not get in the way of her strength. And indeed, Kat told me that when she says this, it often stops people in their tracks. If people often tell you that you're too nice at work, the first step is to find out exactly what they mean. Maybe they have noticed an area where you need to exert a bit more strength, such as my need to stop yesing the Coke client to death and responding to everything with, "That's interesting." Try asking a simple follow-up question such as, "Is there a specific gap that you see?" Or, "How do you think this is hurting me?" If this person does point out a specific weakness, then that's a great area to focus on as you read the rest of this book. However, if the answer is too general, vague, or reveals that this person simply isn't accustomed to dealing with someone at work who owns her kindness, it's time to turn this assumption around. Instead of shying away from the conversation, take the opportunity to explain how you've found kindness to be an important asset at work. Maybe give the person a few examples of those times when being nice at work has helped you and the company. Not long ago, I read an interview with Marjorie Kaplan, who led Animal Planet and TLC for years. about how she responds when people tell her that she's too nice. She said, "I've had people say to me, 'I wonder if you're too nice.' Some of that is because I'm a woman. What I have said in response is, 'I am nice, and I want to be nice. There's not such a thing as too nice. But my expectations are high, and people do rise to my expectations. That's how I manage. I don't manage based on fear. I manage based on expectations." It's easy for women to be read as too nice, too kind, but it's important to be able to make that choice. One of the values that I, as a person and as a woman, bring to the workplace is that I want to be nice at work. Niceness and kindness are not the opposite of ambition and drive. It is powerful to choose to be nice. 5 ways to respond when people say you are too nice. Try any combination of the following, or come up with your own response so that you're never caught off guard. 1. I know, and it's really served me well. 2. Don't mistake my kindness for weakness. 3. You say that as if it's something negative. 4. I've come to realize that it is actually possible to be nice and strong. They are not mutually exclusive. 5. It's better than the alternative. Who wants to deal with a jerk? It starts with you. Maybe until now you've been so concerned about other people's feelings at work that you've become a bit of a pushover. Or perhaps you've had a difficult time embracing your genuine kindness and have succeeded by using some rougher tactics that you don't necessarily feel great about. No matter where you currently fall on the niceness spectrum, it's okay. We're not taught how to balance being nice and strong at work, so it only makes sense that you may have veered too far in one direction or the other. Don't beat yourself up or waste time feeling guilty about it. I see this far too often in the young women I mentor and even in more senior women in the workplace. They do the best they can at the time and then are so hard on themselves for failing to get it exactly right. Just the other day, I was talking to a company founder who was struggling with her business. She told me that over the years, she felt the need to act tough at work in order to succeed. But now she realizes that this hardline approach has been bad for her business in the long run. She has hurt people along the way and lost their trust, and now she feels emotionally disconnected. Even worse, she needs to raise another round of financing for her business, and she has zero support. She realized that she had made a big mistake by not being kinder to others throughout her career. She asked me what her first step should be in making the transition to being kinder at work. And I told her that the first thing she had to do was cut herself some slack. I could hear in her voice how disappointed she was in herself, and I reminded her that she couldn't be kind to others if she wasn't first kind to herself. So now I want to say the same thing to you. Kindness starts with you. If you've judged yourself harshly over the years, you need to let go of that. Remember, part of being authentically nice is embracing the real you. And you can't do that if you're busy beating yourself up for the things you've done imperfectly in the past. It's time to stop leaving your kind and nurturing self at the door when you get to work in the morning, and to start honoring your capacity for connection and relationships. Coupled with the techniques you'll learn throughout this book to be more decisive, negotiate successfully, advocate for yourself, and communicate clearly and directly in every possible workplace scenario, your authentic niceness will propel you forward on the career path of your choice. After all, nice is your superpower. Key takeaways. Being nice and being strong at work are not mutually exclusive. When you own your kindness and use it with intention, it can help vault you to the top. When I talk about being authentically nice, I'm describing a woman who is considerate, respectful, fair, collaborative, and generous. Don't fake it till you make it. My definition of nice is all about doing the right thing because it feels right to you, not because of what's in it for you. If someone tells you that you're too nice, try asking a simple follow-up question, such as, "Is there a specific gap that you see?" Or, "How do you think this is hurting me?" Chapter 2. Be ambitious and likable. Right after I started writing this book, I attended the Women in the World Summit in New York City, where Hillary Clinton spoke about women leaders and likability. Don't worry, I'm not going to get political here. Regardless of your political beliefs or what you think about Clinton, I think we can all agree that she knows a thing or two about how challenging it can be for women leaders to be seen as likable. Sure enough, Clinton addressed the fact that for men, success and ambition tend to be correlated with likability. That is, the more successful a man is, the more likable he becomes. But with a woman, it's the exact opposite. The more successful and ambitious a woman is, the less likable she becomes. There's a lot of research to back this up. In one study from Columbia University's Business School, researchers described a fictional entrepreneur to a group of business students. They told one group of students that the entrepreneur's name was Howard, and the other group that her name was Heidi. Everything else about them was identical, but the students' responses were direct opposites. The group that heard about Howard said that he seemed like someone they'd like to work with, while the other group reported that Heidi seemed unappealing and selfish. As I listened to Clinton talk, I felt a knot in my stomach. Everything she said rang true to me. Early in my career, women leaders were few and far between, and the ones I did encounter were often labeled as bitchy or difficult when they asserted themselves in the same way that a male leader would have been rewarded for. As a result, some of the other women I worked with went too far in the other direction. By bending over backwards to please others, they became known as being weak or pushovers. I thought to myself, if one of the most successful and powerful women in the world still hasn't been able to figure this out, what hope do the rest of us have? Clinton explained that as Secretary of State, she had an extremely high approval rating. But as soon as she announced her run for president, it dropped significantly. A lot has already been written about her likability, or lack thereof. And there are certainly many other factors besides her gender that made her an unpopular candidate. But there's no doubt that this unconscious and pervasive bias against ambitious women is real. In every industry I've worked in throughout my career, including media, finance, venture capital, and even nonprofits, women are still drastically underrepresented in leadership positions. While I had team leaders who were female at Ernst & Young, I didn't have a female boss who I reported to consistently until I was 38 years old. Unfortunately, this is a cultural norm. Despite progress in the past few decades, male leaders are still more prevalent, which influences our unconscious expectations. We expect men to be ambitious, but if a woman steps out of line, we question her motives. Why is she doing this? Why is it important to her? Is she selfish? Ultimately, we don't trust her, and that makes her unlikable and at times even threatening. As an ambitious woman who values relationships above most other things, the seemingly impossible combination is something I've struggled with throughout my career. And it's an issue that clearly resonates with many other working women. The ones I surveyed had this to say about the fight to be seen as likable as an ambitious woman. The first word that comes to mind is demeaning. The word nice or likable does not sound like intellectual, driven, powerful, focused, or smart. Words I prefer. Instead, it's amenable, a pushover, sweet, easy to get along with. It is not what I want to identify with. I think about how women are often disadvantaged because of their inclination to be pleasers, to avoid conflict, to not stand up for themselves, and to not want to seem confrontational or combative. I appreciate working with women who are nice, but typically the ones who come across as nicer seem less ambitious and aren't in leadership positions. The issues that these women mention may sound all too familiar, but don't worry. The fact that there is an implicit bias against women who show ambition doesn't mean it's impossible to be a likable woman leader. The way out of the labyrinth created by this double standard is not to focus on coming across as more likable or less ambitious, or to do anything, in fact, to try and appease stereotypes. The answer I've learned is to own your niceness and leverage it in a way that complements your ambition. Your authentic kindness is already inside of you. By tapping into it and using it intentionally, you'll earn people's trust, and that will allow your ambition and niceness to become equally valuable assets. What does it mean to be ambitious? When I think about someone who's ambitious, I think about someone who does three things. They take credit for their own work and ideas. They step up when opportunities arise. And they proactively create opportunities for themselves. Here are some of the techniques I use to balance kindness with each of these aspects of ambition. Take credit. Getting credit for your own accomplishments can be a surprisingly difficult task, especially if more aggressive colleagues are all too willing to take the credit for your work or ideas. A young woman I mentor named Reshma recently faced a frustrating situation. She was on a team that was brainstorming ideas for the name of a new product that their company was launching. And she came up with an idea that everyone in the room immediately loved. She was new at the company and was proud of herself for scoring such an important win early on. However, her colleague John, who was running the team, went to their mutual boss and shared the new product name with him without giving Reshma any credit. In fact, she suspected that John took all the credit for the idea himself. By the time Reshma came to me, she was feeling frustrated and resentful. It was even affecting her work. She asked me why she should bother working so hard when she clearly wouldn't even get credit for her contributions. I asked Reshma why she didn't say anything to her boss. And her response was, "I don't want to seem like I'm bragging, or like I'm only doing my job to get a pat on the back. But it's still frustrating to know that someone else is getting credit for my idea." Reshma perfectly described the double bind that so many women find themselves in at work. They want to get credit for a job well done, and there's nothing wrong with that. But they worry that taking that credit will somehow make them look bad. I suggested some ways that Reshma could take credit without feeling uncomfortably arrogant or coming across as pushy. 1. Tell a story. People naturally love to hear stories, especially when they can learn something from that story. One way to nicely claim credit for your work is to attach a story to the win that teaches the other person something useful. For example, I asked Reshma if there was a specific brainstorming technique she used to come up with her idea. If so, she could casually share that in a manner that was more about teaching than bragging. For instance, she could mention to her boss, "When I came up with the idea for the product's name, I was using a technique called associative brainstorming to free up my creativity. I'd be happy to talk to the team about this technique if you think it might help them in future sessions." This is a much more sophisticated approach than simply asserting, "That was my idea." But the message still comes through loud and clear. Plus, it's a way of putting yourself forward as a leader who's eager to share her expertise. That's ambitious and completely non-arrogant. Bosses are always looking for people who are creative about problem solving. If you can share a strategy that applies to other problems the company might be facing, that is extremely valuable. If your company has regular meetings in which case studies are shared about situations that have gone well and what can be learned from them, think about submitting your win as a case study. This setting gives you an opportunity to tell your story to a larger audience, while also presenting a learning opportunity and at the same time nicely broadcasting your win. Nominate yourself. One way to achieve the recognition you deserve is to be included on a list of the top performers in your industry. How do you think people end up on those lists? They nominate themselves, or someone at their company nominates them. Why not submit yourself to be included on an appropriate list or even an industry award? This is a simple strategy you can use to get credit for your hard work that can potentially lead to a host of opportunities. Some of us feel foolish doing things like this, but there's no reason to feel that way. Why not be recognized for your hard work? And if you don't win or aren't included, you haven't lost anything. If you do make a list, add it to your email auto-signature. When I see a Forbes 30 Under 30 link in a founder's email, it helps them stand out in my very cluttered inbox, and they are more likely to get time on my calendar. 2. Do it one-on-one. If there wasn't a specific or teachable technique that led to the win, you can still take credit in a nice way. In these cases, I find that one-on-one interactions are more effective than group settings. It's easier to control your message and how you're being perceived in an intimate group than it is in front of a big crowd. For example, I told Reshma that when she was talking to recruiters or mentors or even colleagues, she could use those conversations as an opportunity to bring up her success in a humble way by saying, I was really excited that the name I came up with for our company's new product was so well received. Another option I suggested to Reshma was to let her boss know about her win by assuming that he already knew it was her idea. After all, she didn't know for sure that John hadn't shared this information with him. I encouraged her during their next weekly check-in to say something like, did John tell you what a great brainstorming session we had? I was so excited when I heard how much you liked my idea. Reshma balked at this idea at first. She had a close friend in her department named Kim, who had also been in the brainstorming meeting. Kim was angry on Reshma's behalf and offered to tell their boss that Reshma had come up with the idea for the name. When Reshma told me this, I was torn. On the one hand, it was a beautiful example of women supporting each other at work, and I loved that. Yet I really wanted to help Reshma summon the confidence to take credit for her own idea. I reminded her that there was nothing wrong with making it known that she was doing good work. And by doing it without adding anything negative or accusing John of stealing her idea, she could be that perfect combination of likable and ambitious. 3. Be inclusive. Remember, when you have a win at work, it's pretty unlikely that you did it all by yourself. So it's important to share the credit. This sometimes causes a dilemma for nice girls. One unfair criticism of ambitious women is that they're selfish and only out for themselves. So sharing credit when appropriate is clearly a great way to counteract this notion. But how can you avoid going too far in the opposite direction and fading into the background? Over the course of my career, I found that it is possible to share credit without diminishing the importance of your role. In Reshma's case, her idea didn't come at the very start of the brainstorming meeting. It was possible that someone else said something that sparked her brilliant idea, even on a subconscious level. We discussed the fact that she could share the credit by saying something like, "We were having a great conversation when that idea came to me," or "Everyone's thoughts were so helpful in informing my idea." This felt authentic to her, and I was proud of her when she told me at our next meeting that she decided to use this approach with her boss. It clearly established her as the owner of that winning idea, while also elevating the contributions of those around her. 5 ways to share success with others. If someone who doesn't report directly to you did a good job on an important project or did something to help you earn a win, send an email to that person's boss saying so and copy your colleague on the email. Doing so will take 10 seconds and make her feel so appreciated. Call out a coworker's good job at a meeting. Have her stand up while everyone claps. Take a colleague out to lunch to celebrate teaming up on a job well done. Treat a colleague who helps you earn a win to a small gift card from her favorite place. For example, text her a gift certificate to Starbucks if you know she gets a latte every morning on the way to work. If a boss or other colleague mistakenly credits you for someone else's work, call it out without making them feel foolish. Say something like, "Wasn't that great? That was Janet's idea." Better yet, take the lead and say, "Janet came up with a terrific idea," before someone mistakenly attributes it to you. Step up. A huge part of being ambitious is raising your hand to jump at new opportunities. Sadly, I've seen that many of the women I've worked with and mentored over the years are less likely to truly believe in their capabilities than their male peers. There's research to support the idea of this confidence gap. In study after study, men overestimate their abilities, while women underestimate theirs. When Hewlett-Packard was looking to place more women in top leadership positions, they found that women were likely to apply for a promotion only when they believed they met a full 100% of the qualifications listed for the job. In other words, they only applied if they were a perfect match for the role. Men, on the other hand, felt fine applying if they met only 60% of the qualifications. This discrepancy is huge, and it directly translates into the underrepresentation of women in leadership positions. I admit I've been guilty of this at times in my own career. I was working at MoviePhone when AOL bought it and subsequently merged with Time Warner. I was in my early 30s and had been at MoviePhone for a few years, and I was starting to feel an itch to do something different. I heard that the senior leadership was putting together a team to bridge the gap between AOL and Time Inc., Time Warner's magazine publishing division. There was some tension between the two divisions, so they were looking for people with particularly good interpersonal skills who could help the two groups work together. This opportunity sounded like a great fit for me, and I loved the idea of working on the Time Inc. brands. I wanted to step up, but I was hesitant. I had never worked in magazine publishing, and all those iconic Time Inc. brands, Time, Fortune, People, etc., were intimidating. I knew that some of the smartest people in publishing worked on those brands, and I found myself second-guessing my own qualifications. I had a male colleague at AOL who was in a very similar situation and had the same level of experience as me. But unlike me, he jumped to make this move right away. Knowing that I had strong interpersonal skills, he encouraged me to join him. As it turned out, taking that opportunity led me to a whole new career at Time Inc. I now know that my colleague and I unwittingly exemplified the most common behaviors of our genders. It's typical for men to step up right away, while equally qualified women tend to hang back and wait to be pulled in. I see the women I mentor doing this all the time, doubting their own abilities and failing to step up until they feel fully and often even overqualified. So, if women are losing ground because we undervalue ourselves, what can we do about it? The first step, simple as it may sound, is to be aware. If an opportunity comes your way that intrigues you, but that you think you may not be qualified for, remind yourself that you probably are a better fit than you realize. Then adjust your self-assessment. Remember the study showing that men often apply for jobs when they meet only 60% of the qualifications? So ask yourself, am I 60% qualified for this opportunity? If the answer is yes, go for it. A man with the exact same qualifications as you probably would. I share more techniques for building your confidence in Chapter 5. On top of the confidence gap, women are often held back by inadvertently boxing ourselves into a narrow understanding of who we should be. Ever since elementary school, we've been taught to be good girls who sit at our desks all day getting work done. Studies show that elementary school teachers treat boys and girls differently, often unconsciously. They praise girls for being neat, quiet, and calm, while encouraging boys to think independently, to be active, and to speak up. And yes, while you absolutely have to get your job done, it's also essential to keep your head up. By that, I mean getting up from your desk and looking at what's going on around you. Where are the opportunities and openings? The places you can wedge yourself in by volunteering to take on more responsibilities. Some of the women I've mentored avoid this because they're worried about being too pushy. But I can tell you from experience how much leaders appreciate it when someone steps up to take on more responsibilities or sees an opportunity. I know how tempting it can be to just stay focused, do your job, and go home. But that's not how you get ahead. And it's definitely not all that nice girls have to offer the world. In order to step up, you need to look up. Here are some ways to do it without feeling pushy. 1. Simplify things. Early in my career, when I was working at Coke, I saw how much information was being thrown at my boss every day. Report after report, email after email, and meeting after meeting. Putting myself in his shoes and imagining what it was like to try and take all of this information in, while managing hundreds of employees, I saw how overwhelming it must have been for him. I made it my goal to always approach him with the key information condensed as much as possible, so he could quickly get up to speed and make an informed decision. In all honesty, this created a lot more work for me. It took me hours to take a complex financial analysis that was spread across many spreadsheets and boil it down to one page with only the essential information. Of course, it would have been much easier for me to just go into his office with all of the spreadsheets. At this point, you may be thinking that this is just a story of me being subservient, but stick with me. It was actually my way of stepping up, in a nice way. I knew my boss would appreciate how I went out of my way to save his valuable time. Plus, it made it easier for my boss to make a quick decision about whatever I was presenting, and that in turn helped me be more effective in my role. A few years later, I was only 29 years old when that same boss promoted me to become the director of finance for a $1 billion division of Coke. Suddenly, I had 140 people reporting to me, many of whom had been working at Coke for years. I didn't understand what I'd done to earn this promotion ahead of all of these people who were much more experienced and senior, not to mention older than me. So I directly asked my boss, why me?